We are Israel, is the freest, most innovative, most initiative-taking society in the world. And as an emergent regional superpower, together with our cousins in the UAE and Saudi Arabia, we can define this region as a future model for the world.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute and your co-host. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Every week here on the Mideast Horizons podcast, we go beyond the headlines and the noise to bring you fresh insights on the most critical issues on the Israeli and Middle East national security agenda, and also on the most important trends and opportunities taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read your comments and your emails, so please keep sending them. This week, we're going to speak to Michael Eisenberg, who is one of Israel's, in fact, one of the world's leading venture capitalists and investors, and also one of the most important Israeli thinkers at that critical intersection between technology, national security, and Jewish and Zionist values. But before we get to Michael, Lav, you were at the Prime Minister's press conference yesterday. You gave a press conference to the foreign media and then a press conference to the international media about the upcoming Gaza operation. What did you hear? What was your impression? And what do you think is different this time?
For starters, Netanyahu is in this situation where nobody's happy with, basically. He has pressure from the right and the left for different reasons. I would say the Israeli right and left, and then the world. So he hadn't given a press conference in English in a year. He'd given a few interviews basically to Fox, and maybe there's others that I don't remember, but mostly to Fox over the past year, but not press conferences. It was clear that he felt like he had to explain what was happening. And before I get into the content, he gave a great Netanyahu performance. There's a new press room. He has no staff, hardly any staff running his comms, but he has a new press room in the prime minister's office with a big screen that he could use for his visual aids that he likes. And, you know, he was like making his little Netanyahu kind of quips, and he was speaking very well. He put on a great Netanyahu show. But the thing that I kept like thinking about is that there's like the Ronald Reagan quote, "If you're explaining, you're losing." I think it's Ronald Reagan, where I felt like if we've gotten to this point where he has to do a PowerPoint slideshow to explain why Israel's expanding the war effort and why Israel isn't starving Gaza, like, it just shows that we have a very big problem, you know? Once we get into the content, right, so with the expansion of the war to Gaza City, right, that's the decision that the cabinet approved. On the one hand, the opposition in Israel thinks that it endangers the hostages too much, that the war needs to end, the soldiers are too exhausted, etc. On the right, they say, what happened to the plan to take over all of Gaza? If you're only taking over, there's basically, Netanyahu had this map that made it very clear. But like, basically, let's say Gaza is roughly like a rectangle. There are two little bubbles, or half bubbles, because they're both on the shore, inside of Gaza. One is Gaza City. The other is what the Israeli media has been calling the central camps and the Moasi, which are towns that are built on former refugee camps.
You mean two areas that Israel hasn't operated in extensively to date, or hasn't operated in and stayed there to date?
Correct. So that makes up the 25% of Gaza's territory that Israel hasn't taken over yet, right? And then the cabinet decision from last, it was Friday morning, I guess. There was a 10-hour meeting that started on Thursday evening. They decided to take over Gaza City, which means you're still leaving a chunk of Gaza, whether it's, you know, 10%, 12%, whatever it is of Gaza, that the IDF still wouldn't be operating. So, right, it's like, why are we only doing a half measure? And apparently this is a reflection of the conversation that happened inside the cabinet room that people in the cabinet leaked, because this wasn't in the official decision that was published. But apparently the goal is to continue to pressure Hamas to come to the negotiating table, reach a ceasefire and hostage deal. Whereas, you know, the idea that people who oppose this decision have been saying is, no, we just need to defeat Hamas at this point. Like, we keep trying to have ceasefire deals. We keep slowing down the war effort to reach ceasefires and to get hostages out, and it's not working.
That's what struck me. It seemed like Netanyahu was aware of the urgency of moving forward quickly in the operation. And that probably comes also from the wear and tear in Israeli society, the reservists have done so many days of duty, and also from pressure, likely from the Trump administration, the international campaign to recognize a Palestinian state. And I think also, you know, there's been a lot of discourse lately about the decline in public opinion, Israel's standing in the United States. And it's obviously a result of the war.
I think that it was reactive. That's the thing. I think it was reactive. Like, first of all, the initial statement that they put out was only Gaza City. And then they show this map with these two areas, and he starts talking about everything. And I actually asked Netanyahu's spokesman after if he could clarify this. Netanyahu's talking about everything, but the cabinet decision is only Gaza City. And he's like, oh, well, if after they take Gaza City, it's necessary, then they'll take the rest, right? And then there was the other thing with the timeline, right? Where it was widely reported that the IDF said there was going to be a 2-month timeline, or that they're giving the Gazans 2 months to evacuate Gaza City before the IDF enters, right? And then all of a sudden in the press conference, Netanyahu goes, oh, in the Hebrew press conference, the foreign press conference, by the way, he says, I'm going to instruct the IDF to speed up the timeline. And to me, it sounded like he didn't instruct them in the cabinet meeting. He saw the negative reactions, and now he's reacting. And look, it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? If he reacts and he does the right thing in the end, then great. But that was, it just sort of added to my sense in this press conference that it was a defensive press conference and that it looked weak.
I'm just worried that we're going to end up with the worst of both worlds, right? One option in theory is to say, okay, we're ending the war and we're leaving Hamas in power and we're retreating. I don't personally, and I think at the Miskavit Institute, we don't think that's an acceptable option. Another option is to say, okay, let's quickly defeat Hamas. Let's go all in. Let's operate simultaneously in all the areas that we haven't operated to date. And let's essentially break Hamas's back by eliminating enough of its fighters, enough of its infrastructure and its commanders to really finally achieve the goal of defeating Hamas. But here, when they enter into, first of all, the Hamas has, according to what you reported, has 2 months to prepare, maybe less now if Netanyahu changes his plans, but has plenty of time to prepare. Then Israel moves into Gaza City. Hamas still has that outlet that they can run to the camps in the Deir al-Balah and the areas in the center of the Gaza Strip. And then Israel is also declaring that at any point that the pressure gets too great, it's not declaring, but the implication is that at any point where Hamas feels that the pressure is too great, then they can agree to a full hostage deal or a partial hostage deal or to negotiations or to a new offer. And then Israel will stop and give Hamas once again time to regroup into the next round of fighting. And even as you said, if Israel will complete the operation in Gaza City, then it could take time. There'll be another debate, another cabinet meeting, and another media storm about moving into the center of Gaza. So I think on the one hand, I fear that according to the current logic, you won't get to this final defeat of Hamas, at least not in the near term. On the other hand, you'll have the dragging out of the war, and you might end up with the worst of both worlds. Now, there are real considerations. I mean, it's true. The army and the reservists, after fighting for so many months, do need to rest, and the army does need to prepare. But given the need to defeat Hamas, given the need to do it quickly, because I do think that the timeline that we have is running out, or the price that we're paying for the continuation of the operation is getting higher and higher, Israel's focus should be on defeating Hamas as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've really put your finger on the issue here, which is that, like, Netanyahu proposed this thing that I don't even want to call it, like, right-wing, just the more hawkish move than what the IDF was suggesting. Then it became this whole political spill inside Israel. And then ultimately he took this middle road, which doesn't really have the advantages of either the IDF suggestion, which is just to surround those areas, or the other suggestion, which is to completely go in and invade, you know, seize those remaining parts of Gaza. It's like you have the disadvantages of both, and you only have the, you know, the advantages are halved or whatever. I think we should also talk about the national pressure, which comes from sort of a different direction entirely, right? Which is about the human rights issue. You're starving Gaza, or, you know, you have all these places of pictures of places that, you know, there's basically no buildings left there. And as you said, like in the Misgab Institute, like we do not consider it acceptable to just one day wake up and say the war is over and leave. Like we have to actually win. But on the other hand, there's this unfortunate reality where the more the war drags on, the worse Israel's standing is internationally.
I agree. And that's a really important consideration. I think it was a Pew poll that found that support or approval, or I guess disapproval for Israel increased from 2022 to the currently 2025. I think it was among Democrats from 53% disapproving to 67% disapproving. And among Republicans, I think it was from 27% or having an unfavorable view of Israel to 37% having an unfavorable view of Israel. So this price is real. And its implications, certainly in the long term, U.S.-Israel relations are critical, whether it's U.S. support, besides the fact that we have common values and we like to think of ourselves as allies and as partners. But on a very practical, concrete level, Israel is the U.S. support in the international arena, in the military R&D and military munitions is quite critical. Therefore, doing what we can to end this operation more quickly is key. But as I think Netanyahu said, on the other hand, we're not going to commit suicide in order to get a good op-ed.
Yeah, that was a great line.
Right. So due to negative public opinion, Israel can't say, okay, fine, then we're just going to stop and let Hamas retake Gaza and leave our hostages there and hope for the best. And I have things with a European diplomat who kept telling me for an hour and a half, they kept saying, a European ambassador, well, the problem is that Israel hasn't put forward a diplomatic plan. And I kept asking them, think of any diplomatic plan you want, right? It could be the United States and the EU and Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Morocco and Fatah and Dahlan and whoever you want it. How are you going to get from coming up with a nice diplomatic plan to removing Hamas from power? Because there's no other force that's going to remove Hamas from power other than Israel. So then given that leaving Hamas in power isn't an option, given this shortened timeline or the higher price that we're paying, that would seem to, you know, imply that Israel needs to defeat Hamas, like I said before, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, to even put a finer point on it, like any country that would be interested in building Gaza and helping administer Gaza, right? People talk about the moderate Sunni states. I'm sure some European countries would put some money in. Nobody's going to do that when Hamas is still there, right? Like, especially the moderate Sunni states, like they're not fooled the way the Europeans are. they're not going to be involved until Hamas is eradicated. And so that's why the war has to continue. But there's definitely a lot of people who are deluded about this. And we talk about this later in the podcast with Michael Eisenberg about the Europeans. I read an article today from the New York Times that was like about how like amazingly stunning and brave Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron are for recognizing a Palestinian state. And they called it like transformative will. And I just like read this and I was like, what planet is this article on? And it's just a continuation. You know, we talked about they were publishing the pictures that were supposedly of starving children, and they were, I mean, terrible pictures of children who are suffering, but they had congenital diseases, right? And it's just like there's this like alternative reality that the world is seeing, and it's really hard to cut through that and make them actually see the facts of what's going on. And like Netanyahu himself, and I also last week or 2 weeks ago heard Gideon Saar say that like some of these world leaders, after they came out these declarations, they're going to recognize a Palestinian state, or when they sent this letter of 26 countries pressuring Israel, and then Hamas like left the hostage talks and they showed how they've been starving Israeli hostages. Suddenly some of these countries behind the scenes say that they regret what they did because they realized it was counterproductive. Well, say it out loud. If it was counterproductive, why don't you counter that by being productive, right? It's a very frustrating situation.
Something that's a bit more optimistic, you mentioned Israel's moderate Sunni partners. This week, we're going to mark 5 years to the historic phone call brokered by President Trump between Prime Minister Netanyahu and then Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, now President of the UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, which the two countries announced normalization. You were on one of those first delegations to the UAE. I still remember those videos of you guys walking around the museum. And that essentially opened the door to the Abraham Accords. Bahrain then joined. We saw this incredible flourishing of innovation and trade and tourism and people-to-people and interfaith dialogue. And then October 7th happened, and there was a real question as to whether or not the Abraham Accords would survive. And 22 months later, the Abraham Accords have proven resilient. And it's interesting, we looked at the economic data, the trade data. I would say it's the only indication, but it's an important indication. In 2024, year over year, as opposed to 2023, Israel's trade with the UAE, with Bahrain, with Morocco, even with Egypt and Jordan grew. Now, if we looked at the data now for 2025, for the first half of 2025, and we saw that the trade with Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco continues to grow year over year. With Bahrain and the UAE, it's slowed, but it's gone back to 2023 levels. So we don't have that surge we saw in 2024, but it's back to the pre-war levels. So that has survived. Now, going forward, how can we restore the momentum of this war and peace? And that's obviously a priority of the Trump administration being the peacemaker. I do think that there's a role for these countries in Gaza on the day after, if and when we do get to a day after Hamas. That's on Israel to get to that day after Hamas. And then there's going to be a need a lot of work, whether it's via multilateral initiatives like the India, Middle East, Europe corridor, which brings together a number of countries, the Middle East Security Alliance, and Abraham Accords Innovation Network, joint US, UAE, Israeli AI centers, joint work on water desalination, multilateral work, multilateral people-to-people, youth initiatives with Israel, its partners in the Abraham Accords, then also countries outside that are supportive. That, I think, is one important way of moving forward. I do think, though, that the fact is that while the Abraham Accords ties have been maintained, it's going to take a period of calm in the Gaza Strip before we see an expansion to more countries.
Yeah, the country everybody wants to talk about is Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have definitely said, we're going to put this on hold right now. But I think, like, if we look back 5 years ago to the, you know, to the Abraham Accords when they were first announced, it is pretty incredible. I mean, at the time, there were all these, like, articles trying to burst the bubble, right, by people who don't like Trump, by people who don't like Israel, saying that it was just an arms deal, right? That the UAE was just doing this because they wanted to, I think they wanted to get the F-35. That's what it was at the time. But basically, it was, you know, saying like it's not real. It's not genuine. And in a way, it's like the most genuine of any of the peace that Israel has made with any countries. It's survived and it's thrived. I mean, it was incredibly exciting for me to be like, you know, witnessing this history at the time. And you played your own part starting all of these organizations that, you know, helped nurture ties between Israelis and Emiratis. And I'm hopeful that when this war does end, that those ties will grow and more countries. The fact that the Emiratis have, and the Bahrainis and the Moroccans, but I think the relationship with the UAE is like the strongest. And the fact that they've kept it up just will serve as a really good example and a motivation for more countries moving forward.
So talking about being hopeful and being optimistic and also on the potential for cooperation between Israel and its Abraham Accords partners and with Saudi Arabia, this week we're going to speak to Michael Eisenberg. Michael is one of Israel's most influential and important thinkers at the critical intersection between technology, national security and prosperity, and Jewish and Zionist values. A native of New York, he moved to Israel in 1993 and lives in Jerusalem, where he and his wife are raising their 8 children. He has been a driving force in Israeli high tech for the last 3 decades, at Israel Seed Partners and at Benchmark Capital. And in 2013, he founded Aleph, which is one of Israel's leading VCs and is behind some of Israel's most exciting and successful startups. But beyond the VC and investment world, Michael is also a prolific author and public commentator, combining deep insights into economy and technology trends with values and lessons from Jewish sources. He frequently weighs in on issues of national importance and consults to Israel's leaders. He's also devoted a huge amount of time and energy to social organizations like Hashomer HaChadash and the Nevo Network, which helps young immigrants to Israel integrate into Israel's high-tech ecosystem. He is the host of the Invested podcast, which I highly recommend checking out. So stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Michael Eisenberg. Michael, it's great to have you with us on the Mideast Horizons podcast. You're widely considered one of Israel's most strategic and perceptive investors. When you look at the Israeli tech ecosystem over the next 5 years, when you look at Israeli society in general over the next 5 years, what makes you optimistic and what makes you worried?
Why don't you start with a more softball question? Hey, how are you? How's your day going? Something?
Why don't you start by telling us where you are?
I'm up north in an old village that was founded by Baron Rothschild in 1889, a place called Bat Shlomo. It was one of the few places in Israel that's actually preserved in its original state. Bat Shlomo, named after Betty Rothschild, daughter of Solomon. What happened is it's actually a settlement that failed in the 1880s. And so the same 12 houses and the synagogue and the mikveh building still exists here, and it's never been expanded, and it's surrounded by a national park called the Khurshan Park or Park Alona up here, and it's a farming village where people still farm the land the way they did in the 1800s when the early settlers and Zionists came here. And I've been fortunate enough to purchase some land up here, and we have a farm, and that's where I am. Since then, by the way, a partner of mine and I started a winery. He now runs it and owns it, Eli Wortman, called the Bat Shlomo Winery. Our farm is called Lev Adam, which is named after the famous song about the Western Wall, which goes, Yesh Anashim Sheish Lehem Lev Me'evin V'yesh Avanim Sheish Lehem Lev Adam. There's some people with a heart of stone and some stones with a heart of a person. And so that's what it's called. We make wine, veggies, organic vegetables. We have kids from around here who farm the land. So part of what makes me optimistic, now getting to your question, Asher, is the youth of Israel. There was a piece, I think it was in The Economist or the FT, that came out like in the last 48 hours, which said that kids in the United States are less conscientious. People take less responsibility. Young people, they obviously have more anxiety, etc. In Israel, 2 years into this war that nobody wanted, 2 years into a war that saw hundreds of thousands of people called up to reserves, we've had sons-in-law who have probably done more than 1,500 days of reserve duty in Gaza or mandatory service in Gaza. We currently have two kids in the army right now. These kids have proven to be what I called already in November 2023, the defining generation. It's not just a defining generation for Israel, it's a defining generation for the West. These were kids that everybody was worried about, that they were behind their screens, Instagram, TikTok, who put it all aside and got up to defend the values of Israel, the safety of Israel, the people of Israel, and by extension, the entire nationhood, let's call it, of Western civilization, because Islamism is on the rise, and Hamas is not even an extreme version of Islamism. It is one of the variants of this disease called Islamism, which is a mutant form of Islam, promulgated by the Muslim Brotherhood. And these kids stood up, risked their lives. Some of them lost their lives. I lost two cousins since October 7th, and stood up and defined this. So why the most important reason to be optimistic about Israel is the young people here who have shown incredible courage, conscientiousness, responsibility, fortitude and innovation in tackling this problem. As I've said many times before, and I'm a high-tech investor in my day job, the amount of innovation that this war has brought out of Israelis, both, you know, like magic stuff, you know, the AI and space lasers, et cetera, but also just simple innovation. You know, some guy who turned up on the Gaza border before the tanks rolled in and outfitted my son's tank, you know, with a dash cam, a car dash cam, so that he could see out the rearview mirror, so to speak, right? It's a quote-unquote mirror. It was a dash cam.
I mean, truth is, all the use of the drones before you enter in a house all started as a private initiative. Somebody brought a drone from home, said, before we go into the house, why don't we send the drone in and make sure that there's nobody there waiting for us? And that's become a standard part of the IDF procedure.
100%. And this is, you know, it's a civilian army with civilian innovation that drives down. There's obviously military innovation as well. And so just the amount of ingenuity that's come out is stunning, and people are paying attention to it. You may have seen the U.S. Department of Defense just issued, I think in the last week, you know, they want technologies that have been battle-tested. You know, there's nowhere where technologies have been more battle-tested than Israel. Maybe the Ukraine the second, but certainly in kind of the high-tech wizardry and missiles, et cetera, it's Israel. And so I think that sets us up, you know, for a lot of positives. What worries me? You know what worries me? Lack of political will. And I use one example of it, but you know, the budget, we're borrowing a lot of money to fight this war, and we need to borrow the money to fight the war. But at the same time, people need to rise out of their sectarianism. When I say people, I mean politicians need to rise out of the sectarianism and to make the hard political decisions to cut the budget in places which are not growth investments or investments in security. Period, full stop. I have a piece coming out in Sapir magazine in like a month that details this in gory financial detail. We added 9% to our debt to GDP ratio in the last 20 months. That's a lot. The good news is we came into the war with the world's best, basically, debt to GDP ratio of a growing economy. Germany has a better debt to GDP ratio, but it doesn't grow that economy. It's a very stagnant and stale economy. And it's the best. So we have the latitude to do it, but we can't do it if we don't have the political willpower and courage to make the hard decisions saying what we don't do, because this requires focus and a focus on growth. We need to stop spending and do this. Do we have the willpower to go recruit the ultra-Orthodox, the political willpower to go do that? If the answer to our question is no, that should be cause for concern. But I'm very confident in the young people of this country that they're very clear on both of these topics. And I just recently, I published a book in the middle of the war, which in addition to its Torah or Bible part has an opening, which describes what happens when the welfare state globally fails, and it's failing, by the way. And Israel's in the best state of just about any economy anywhere to be able to stand up the welfare state, but it can't continue on its current path and needs to change.
Why do you think Israel is on the best path? Like, could you explain that?
Now, Israel's in the best current state. It's not necessarily on the best path, which let me do it. So because we went into the war with a debt to GDP ratio in the low 60s, we can finance our welfare state for the most part. However, to the best of my knowledge, there's nobody in the Israeli government or the Ministry of Finance who sits down and says, okay, these dollars, this is for investments in future growth. These dollars, or shekels, I should say, these shekels are, you know, just handouts or part of the welfare state. And the only way to kind of get our debt to GDP ratio back to where it needs to be post the war, and again, we should borrow money to, you know, prosecute this war and win it as fast as possible. The only way to kind of bring it back to where it was and the healthy area was is you need to grow. In order to grow, you need investments in infrastructure. The investments in infrastructure are more limited because we spend way too much on what I call the spending part of the ledger, which is non-investment, which is whether it's, you know, supporting ultra-Orthodox yeshivas or unproductive parts of society. In general, Western society has been taken over by progressive nonsense in which you kind of you fund the fringes instead of focusing on the core of society. The core of Israeli society serves. That's what they do. The fringes, which by the way has been popular with the court system too, there's no sort of individual rights and you got to fund these crazy fringe things. But we can't afford that. And so since we can't afford that, we shouldn't afford it. And we need to make the cuts necessary to be able to focus on the core of society, which is defense. We need to revamp our education system completely.
from the ground up. We have to make sure that our health system is taken care of because we have one of the best health systems on the planet. But it's falling behind because it's both underfunded and there aren't enough doctors and nurses in the system. These are solvable problems, but they need dollars that are being frittered, shekels, they're being frittered away elsewhere.
Is it just an issue of priorities? Because you've also been critical of Israel's strategy in key areas. For example, at the Knesset last year on a hearing on AI, you described Israel's AI approach to AI as amateurish. Basically said that nobody here in the Knesset knows what they're talking about. And at least if you're not going to be helpful, at least don't be unhelpful. Where do you think that Israel in critical tech areas, whether it's AI, whether it's defense tech, which is now the hottest topic, what does Israel need to do in order to ensure its leadership going forward?
Generally in technology, civilian innovation wins. And we're very good at that. Okay, so defense tech, nobody said, hey, go do defense tech. Just people came out of Gaza and said, hey, I saw things, drones or missiles or whatever it is, or AI. I can do this. And so defense tech has popped up without any government help. And that's the way it should be, by the way, kind of, which I'll come back to in a second. AI is an entirely different story. AI is infrastructure for the future nation state, like nuclear power, like nuclear weapons. This is what will define the winning nation states of the coming 100 years. And it's infrastructure. Why is it infrastructure? Because it needs a lot of energy, because it needs a lot of compute, because you need a lot of human beings with a lot of degrees. And we're a small country, so we need to bring some of these people either back because they've left or in because there's not a small number of Jews or other people who want to live in Israel that we can bring into this. The bad news is that the government continues to be amateurish across the breadth. The good news is the following, and I appeared before this commission. The Prime Minister Netanyahu, appointed a commission led by General Nagel, perhaps Nagel in English, and co-chaired, or the under chair of it, if that's the right word, the vice chair of it, was a guy named Ryan Gitti. Tremendous people. They sat down and done work for the last 3 months saying, okay, how do we build an AI strategy for Israel? I may or may not have appeared in front of this commission. I may or may not have had some hand in it. But either way, they did incredible work. And one can nitpick some of the details, but they finally said, okay, here is the strategy for the state of Israel. How we do this? First of all, what do we need to set up? Well, we need to set up a unit in the prime minister's office because unfortunately, you have to keep it out of the political trading, which always happens between these ministries. So it must be in the prime minister's office, like the Mossad, like the Shin Bet. There's going to be an AI infrastructure, an AI mandate, let's call it, or a unit in the prime minister's office to keep it free from the politics. Number two, it needs a lot of money, 25 billion shekels. And we can, again, argue it should be 50 billion, 10 billion, 5 billion shekels a year is a good start. Number three, it should be able to hire the best and the brightest by having flexible salaries and not being dependent on like the labor union salary structure, the government salary structure, because we need the best and the brightest to come want to do this. That's number three. Number four, it should have sweeping authority to approve budgets in other ministries and anything that touches AI, plus incentivize talent to come here and incentivize infrastructure, energy or computer infrastructure to be built. I think this is a huge path forward. We need to see the next 2 weeks is if the government not only accepts the recommendation, but moves to implementing it by appointing somebody very capable to sit at the top of this.
Now they have to get to the prime minister, to the government. What's the next step in terms of making this a reality?
The government. The government needs to decide to make it a reality. And then the finance ministry, and particularly the Office of Management and Budget, needs to allocate the funds for it. You find a budget source. They may have to cut somewhere else, but they should cut wherever they need to in order to make this happen. Because it's going to need to cut across. It's going to have to influence education. It's going to influence health. It's going to influence government employment, by the way. And that's why it needs sweeping powers. There's no reason that AI cannot reduce government budgets by about 20-25%. Completely can pay today. And we need to free up that money to be able to invest in growth so we can grow our way out of the extra deficits that we've taken on and get our debt GDP back to best in class in the world. So it's easy for us to raise money when we need it.
So I have an interesting quote from you here about AI. I'll give it to you. As Europe declines and the East and South rise, Israel and our Abrahamic partners are perfectly placed as the innovation ecosystem that will help drive their economies and drive an AI future in this region and a realigned world. Could you tell us how you think that sort of Israeli innovation and AI can change Israel's standing in the world and the middle change the Middle East more broadly?
Yeah. I often forget the things I say sometimes, so thank you for reminding me. I appreciate it. You know, so I should ask before about strategy. In general, the leadership of Israel has always been very tactical. Part of it, I think, comes from like a survival mentality and instinct. But we are now a regional superpower. Okay? After what's happened on the Seven Front War, we are a regional superpower, and we should aspire to be a regional superpower. That should be an aspiration. To be a regional superpower, you need to think like a regional superpower in this U.S. sphere of alignment. And so that requires much more strategy, but it also requires working with our neighbors. So the UAE has spent incredible of time, energy, money, and professionalism. And it, take your hat off. They've done incredible work on AI strategy for the UAE. And they figured out, to their credit, that what they have in abundance is energy, and their capability to do large projects, I would argue, is almost second to none. These people in this desert area are incredible. The Emiratis are incredible at building infrastructure projects, whether it's the new airport in Abu Dhabi, the airport in Dubai, the energy fields. It's mind-boggling and a sight to behold, and I admire them greatly. That's what they're great at. They are trying to import compute and doing a good job of it. They've made deals with Jensen and NVIDIA and others. The Saudis have launched this initiative called Humane with AI in it instead of A&E at the end. The Saudis, I think, are behind the Emiratis quite candidly, but they have abundant energy and abundant money to be able to bring chips in and perhaps, although I'm skeptical of it, to bring manufacturing in. What they all lack is talent. What do we have? We're actually way less good than the Emiratis at building big projects. We have way less energy abundance, but we have real innovation talent, number one. Number two, we have a relationship with the United States, which wants to kind of own this sphere of AI that almost nobody has. Okay, now we have this new energy agreement that was signed by the Prime Minister when he was in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and an AI agreement. And very friendly people coming in the State Department. My friend Jacob Helberg is going to become the Under Secretary of State for technology and economics and innovation. Now, what does that say? That means we need to coalesce around our talent, Emirati infrastructure building, energy, access to compute, Saudi energy, access to compute, perhaps manufacturing. By the way, I should also add in parentheses, even though Intel is long in the tooth, we're one of the few countries in the world where you can manufacture semiconductors. There aren't that many around the world, right? There's like six of them or seven. And where you have chip design, right? The Irish have semiconductor manufacturing, but no chip design. We've got both. And so we need to coalesce this into a regional framework where this combination of energy, logistics, compute, innovation, talent, and chip design coalesces together to create a sum of the parts that's greater than the value of the parts. And that we need to export south and east, okay? We can, as a group together, help India get into the AI era. We can, as a group, help Indonesia get to that place. There's a billion people in Africa. There's a billion people. Out of 8 billion people, more than 1 billion are in Africa. And a significant number of the young people, it's like 30% under the age of 20 or something like that in Africa. They're going to need to leapfrog into this era of AI. This regional ecosystem can be that. And Israel, as a thinking regional superpower, should be able to help do that. But that requires strategy. It requires a friendly approach to the Gulf countries. It requires that we think what we're best at, what they're best at, and collaborate in a collaborative framework. And so we're not doing that thinking right now. And we need to start doing that thinking. I'm hoping this AI unit in the PM office will start doing some of that. But it's not only in AI we need to start thinking this way. There's many areas. Logistical supply chains across the Middle East and into the South. How do we connect to IMEC? I don't know if you know this, but Israel's not part of IMEC right now, for real, right? We're not signed on IMEC. That can't be. That requires a strategic framework.
Let's just put a pin in a second, because maybe some of our listeners don't know what IMEC is.
Yeah, IMEC is the Indian-Middle East Corridor. It is the alternative to the Belt and Road Initiative promulgated by China. okay? And it is a key part of U.S. foreign and commerce policy to ensure the India-Middle East corridor is able to ship goods from the Far East out to Europe. That runs via Israel. It needs to run via Israel, but we're not signed on it. And so we need far more strategic government to be able to think like a superpower, a regional superpower, to act like a regional superpower, and to be collaborative with our regional partners here. And the Emiratis want it. God bless them. They've stuck with us for the last 20 months. God bless MBZ. Okay? And the Saudis have hung in there also in their own way. And so we got to kind of start to coalesce this. And I think there's others that will join. The Azeri-Armenian peace treaty now is a further chance. And to kind of bring more people in, because they sit right at the heart of that BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, and they'll kind of frame this, you know, with the new corridor that President Trump so smartly led together with my good friend Arya Lightstone. You know, we got real opportunities, but when you start to behaving on it, we need people who can think at this scale and this level. And unfortunately, they're not occupying most of the seats of government right now.
That's a really good point. I mean, you know Israeli politics as well as anyone.
No, I don't.
You know them very well. What you're saying makes so much sense, but then you look at the coalition politics and the giving out of the different portfolios and the primary system, and the question is, can we get there? I mean, you can be supportive of Prime Minister Netanyahu, you can be critical of Prime Minister Netanyahu, but he certainly has had a vision for the Israeli economy and for Israeli technological development. But when you look at the broader political spectrum, you don't seem to have that kind of strategic thinking. What do you think? How do we get to that point where the private sector is going to continue to be dynamic?
Well, even Netanyahu, right? Like, he has a vision, but it's often subsumed by the politics because he has coalition partners that don't share that vision, right? Like, I would say a minority of the Knesset is actually a free market capitalist, you know, part.
And it's not, in many areas like AI, it's not enough for the startup ecosystem, for the private sector. You need that top-down governmental support, assistance, guidance, empowerment. So how do we get there? Do you think there's a roadmap to getting there?
I want to, by the way, correct something that Lahav said with such certainty. I actually think that a not small part of the Likud party currently in government is socialist. All the ultra-Orthodox parties are socialists, even though, by the way, the base of these parties are not socialists. Some people would call them clientists rather than socialists, which is that, you know, they want to...
They're populists.
You know, populists in some way pander to their clientele, or, as was reported, the Miri Regevland, the transport ministry, the Diamonds. But... fundamentally, many of them are socialists. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu is a capitalist. I think below him on the list are a lot of people who unfortunately have the wrong view of economics or forgot what socialism is. And certainly the ultra-Orthodox who just want handouts without responsibility. And this is not the base, by the way. This is the machers who are currently... the members of Knesset, they just want to kind of keep the people underfoot. What do you do about this? Well, I don't know. To use a different example, because it's less personal, you ask yourself, how is it plausible that Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the UK, could have said such a dumb thing over the last 2 weeks? I don't think there is a dumber statement ever made by a politician than Keir Starmer. And by the way, we should say it openly, he may have killed the hostages, okay, by kind of caving to Hamas, the Palestinian narrative.
And that's what Rubio said about Macron, right? That the negotiations fell apart.
Yeah, exactly. Macron also. These perhaps, we should be careful, you know, perhaps may be responsible for the life of our hostages. We've been there for well over 600 days, closing in on 700 days because of stupid things that they said. We said, why is people so stupid? That's a plausible. You can be the prime minister of the country, be so stupid. And the answer is, because all politics, at the end of the day, are local. When you're in a democracy, my friend Eugene Candle once said this. He was the former economic advisor of the prime minister. He said the key KPI of every politician is to get reelected. That's what they want. And you look at the voting bases, you know, under Starmer and under Macron, there's a lot of Islamists there in these countries. And so they're pandering to the base. Cost somebody else's life, of course, potentially. God forbid. Really, God forbid. But they're pandering to their base. And I think a lot of this in democratic politics, unfortunately, comes down to a lack of leadership and people who pander to the base. And populism has become popular again. But you know, laws of physics, for every action, there's an equal and forceful reaction. I hope that there is going to be an era of leadership that follows this era of populism. Because I think people are sick and tired of the amateur hour that has become much of government technology and economic policy. Sick and tired of it. And they're sick and tired of the cost of living going up here. You know, it's ridiculous. The government declared a cost of living commission. Do you know how many times the cost of living commission met? I think it was once on the day after it was announced. It never met again. I wrote a piece about this. If you actually want to do something about cost of living, you have to have twice weekly meetings with KPIs and an action list that you peck through to go do this. You think they met? They didn't meet. Shmuel Slavin was supposed to lead it. He's the former director general of the finance ministry. I bumped into him, I don't know, a couple of months ago. I said, "Hey, how are the meetings going?" Wink, wink. And he said, "What meetings? Well, I forgot about that commission. They never called together." Can't run a country like this when you want to be a regional superpower. You, by the way, you can't run a country like this in the modern era. And we need to fix that. And it will get fixed. This younger generation is incredible. They're going to fix it.
It's known that when Netanyahu forms a committee, it means that it's something he doesn't want to deal with, right? It's at this point, it's become a cliche. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, well, I think that's true, except there's people suffering. I don't think he doesn't want to deal with it, by the way, for what it's worth. And I think it was, I'm not sure who it was who formed the committee or the commission. And by the way, the AI commission was formed, and look, it delivered results. And the Defense Budgeting Commission, was also run by Nagel, was formed. And I don't know if it's worked. We'll find out. She presented a report.
Yeah.
I'm unpersuaded that there are many people in government who understand economics.
Yeah. You know better than me, but I definitely agree with you on that. I want to ask you.
Here's an interesting question for you. Did you ever ask yourself how many people in this government had jobs before they went into politics?
I mean, I haven't sat and counted, but a lot of them, not all, but a lot.
Okay.
I mean, they were like activists on the side, but they did have other jobs. You know, I don't know, like Eli Cohen, right? The energy minister. He was in, I think he was even in finance.
Yeah, yeah, he had a job.
And he got into politics relatively young, but he had a job.
Nir Barkhad is another. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Most of them have just been activists, though.
Gideon Saar was a journalist and a lawyer for a very short time. I think maybe he was like 30 or something when he entered politics, but he did have a job.
Counsel in university.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So I want to ask you about a different economic question. It's been reported that you were sort of involved with coming up with the idea for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. What can you tell us about that process? And also, how do you think it's working? How do you think it's going?
You need to really ask the New York Times and the Washington Post who reported this. Generally, I'll say the following. I think Gaza has been an aid state for decades. And he who controls the aid controls the population. And that's been Hamas in cahoots with the UN. It's been a symbiotic partnership between the United Nations and Hamas in delivering aid to the population there. And so whoever controls aid controls the population there, and I think that's just a generic fact. You know, I think Reverend Johnny Moore is the right guy to ask on how GHF is going. He's a remarkable individual,
We interviewed him. He was a very interesting guest. The GHF was around for a couple months, and then suddenly the story of starvation started showing up throughout the media. Israel basically had to allow aid to be flooded into Gaza. Maybe for other choice. So that was the choice that the leadership of Israel made. Let's just flood aid in so that we can say we're not holding any aid back. Do you think the problem is that the GHF wasn't scaled up enough? Was something else that they should have been doing?
And generically, I think there's two things. One is the UN system. And the WFP and OCH and all these other things are giant industries. The aid industrial complex is giant. There are reports about sex trafficking in UN aid areas in Africa. The UN itself has said that they need to give aid to warlords and terrorists and all sorts of places around the world, not just in Gaza, in order to get access to people don't know what that means, quote unquote, access to the people when you fund the terrorists to do this. And so I think it's fair to say, in Biden's own words, that not a large percentage of the aid gets to its recipients. In fact, in the case of Gaza, the UN's own statistics show 87% of the trucks or aid, depending on how you count, fails to reach the end recipient. It is interdicted somewhere along the way. And so if anybody developed a model that shows something successful that threatens the industrial complex, that's going to be a thing. For those people who make a lot of money, and there's tens of thousands of people whose livelihoods and standing in the world depend on the UN aid industrial complex. Some of them, Hillel Neuer, my friend, has done a good job of highlighting at UN Watch. And this is just a giant system that probably feels threatened by Representative Moore.
Johnny Moore is really an incredible guide. He was in some ways doing the Abraham Accords before anybody came up with the brand Abraham Accords. One of the things that when we spoke to him, you know, he was a little bit surprised by the intensity of this campaign of delegitimization and demonization and the way that the UN and European countries and Hamas essentially came together to try to undermine the work that he was doing of distributing millions of meals. But the impact of these kinds of campaigns are being seen not just in Europe, but also there's, as various polls and a lot of discussions take place in the United States as well, where we've seen a drop in public opinion towards Israel. And you've done a lot of work. You've talked a lot about narrative and storytelling and how it applies to startups. But when you look at Israel as a country and Zionism and the Jewish people, How can Israel, do you think there's a way that Israel can improve its narrative, its storytelling in the West and the United States? And what should be the essence of that narrative?
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. I did some work at the beginning of the war on bot networks and how this coordinated campaign got unleashed on October 8th, where suddenly it wasn't just a Hezbollah firegets also, but amazingly, there were Google Drive all over campus in America that had posters that you could download and print. Right, the people were ready for this. An NDRI, Network Engine Research Institute, run by Joel Finkelstein, has done an incredible job recently of charting this. And there is a very, very well-honed narrative meme-making system, probably funded by Qatar in various ways, that has gotten the best of the West. And Israel, too. You have a very complicit media. You just look at that picture of the poor kid with MS that ends up on the cover of all these pages. You look at the inside deliberations of the New Times, where they knew the problem, and they still decided to publish it. It is outrageous. By the way, you can read it on my Twitter. I was probably 16, but I'm calling for the New York Times editor, Joe Kahn, to resign. In this case, Khan got it right, and he still published it. You go, I mean, the guy is complicit in spreading false narratives to a level that nobody, I think anywhere in the world, has given the New York Times Good Housekeeping seal of approval, at least in the eyes of the world, to false narratives. It's unbelievable. It literally, as President Trump says, fake news. The New York Times is fake news. And they do such detailed research, it's remarkable. You can come out with so many fake outcomes. And so now I come to your question, which is, number one, we need to start playing offense and not defense. And unfortunately, I think government and the narrative always reflexive rather than offensive. And we wait for the crisis to happen rather than crafting the narrative ourselves. What is the narrative? Because this is the question you asked. And I think the answer to the question is, we are Israel. Israel is the freest, most innovative, most initiative-taking society in the world. And it is the most mutually responsible society. It's a world where you want to raise your children because they grow up with mutual responsibility for their society. And as an emergent regional superpower, together with our cousins in the UAE and Saudi Arabia
and the southern part of the Mediterranean in Greece and Italy, we can define this region as a future model for the world. I'm going to double down. One of the things that societies in Europe in particular, but it's starting to happen in America too, are struggling with is what happens when I let in too many immigrants that want to undermine my society. What Israel has shown during this war is that by focusing on the core ethos of Israel, the core Zionist ethos, and by the way, I'll argue that the UAE has a core ethos as well, and Saudi has a core ethos as well. Put this to innovation, initiative taking, prosperity, and freedom, and you can change the world for better. Our mutual responsibility model, our focus on family values and having children and societies that give children responsibility, so they develop mutual responsibility for their brothers and sisters, is a model the world should copy. Our model for freedom and initiative taking for young people and give, budgets and opportunity to the young age and responsibility is a model for us the world. Our model, which needs to go back to focusing on the core side instead of the fringes, is a model for the rest of the world, as it should be going forward. And we just stand up and say that. Keir Starmer should take notice that if he follows the Israeli model, the UK has a shot at success in the future. If he doesn't, they're done. Macron should take notice that if the French decide to go back to being French, have children, give them responsibility, invest in families, invest in initiative to create a truly free society like Israel is, have a shot. Otherwise, see you later, buddy.
And we know, not long before all the he announced that he was doing all of this, there was a report that came out on how to deal with Islamism in France. It was like a whole big report that his government came up with. And one of the suggestions was to recognize Palestinian state in the sense of like, we should give in to these people. We should like throw them a bone rather than stick up, for what means to be French.
They're a model country in many ways, although I think we've got one big advantage of them, which is demographic growth. That's much more meaningful than Swiss demographic growth. And we can do this. We have a real set of values that the world should want to emulate. And we should not be embarrassed by them. We should hold up a flag and say, follow us, guys, into the 21st century. We got this.
I want to ask you about the impact that the war is having on the tech sector, because I think, on one hand, there have been economic difficulties due to the war, less than anyone predicted. And on the other hand, Israel is very sort of dynamic, and a lot of businesses know how to improvise really well in this country, the ones that aren't weighed down by unions and all the other social issues we have. And also, you talked in the beginning of our interview about how Israel is this amazing tech case for defense tech, but I would also add, cyber. And from what I understand from, again, the New York Times, is that AI played a very big part in the attacks on Iran. So where do you think things stand for the tech sector in light of the war? Better, worse, somewhere in the middle?
A couple of things. Number one, Israel is the best performing stock market world since October 1st, 2023. It's pretty mind-blowing. Shekel is back to the strength. And by the way, if you look at my Twitter feed, I said, told everyone, stay long the shekel, even when it's get long the shekel.
Whoever's not following Michael on Twitter should definitely start doing that. My recommendation.
Yeah.
You get his weekly Zvar Torahs, his Parsha explanations as well.
There you go.
It's been very resilient. That's number one. Number two, since the war started, numerous funds have set up in Israel, Sequoia, XL, Index. People want to access the innovation. I think your comment about, battle-tested defense technology is important. Cyber is important. But Israel has been, in order for us to get to the next phase, we need things other than cyber and defense tech. I've been working very, very hard and diligently to try to develop the finance sector here. And I think you're going to be surprised. I think our finance minister, Smotrich, has figured this out. And I think you'll see some news in the future.
about regulatory and tax overhaul to enable the emergence of a finance industry, a hedge fund industry here. We need a second industry other than tech. The second thing is, even in tech, cyber has carried us this far. It's not enough to carry us to the next phase. And so great Israeli companies don't necessarily service the local market, but they're really amazing at is because there's not much of a local market is service international market in the get-go. And so, excuse me, we need the AI-enabled services businesses. And you see some of them. We have a business called Spines, which is what's called Vanity Publishing, which everyone knows, you know, Penguin and these other ones were Vanity Publishers. It's a giant industry, by the way. It's almost as big, if not bigger, the kind of mainstream publishing industry that you all know from, you know, Tom Clancy, I'm dating myself now, and others. But Vanity Publishing is a giant business. This is an AI book publisher called Spines. It's growing like a weed. A company called Empathy, you know, which is helping give kin deal with death, both emotionally and financially. And so we need these businesses that are AI-enabled service businesses to sell globally from here. You know, Lemonade, which I got lucky to be the first investor in, is the fastest growing insurance company in the world. It's an AI-native business. We now operate globally, started here. And we need these businesses to grow so that we have more engines of growth other than just cyber and defense. I'm optimistic. One challenge is the following. I wrote about this in a separate call. We don't have enough talent here. And so two choices. Actually, I think we both have the two choices. One is we need a giant investment bringing talent here and bringing back talent here. I was just earlier today with a guy who moved to Tenafly. He's a cancer researcher, moved to Tenafly, New Jersey 9 years ago. I said, why aren't you coming back? He said, well, you know, the judicial reform, the war, this, that, the other. It sounds like, okay, we need these back. And so we need a big investment in bringing them back, really some number. And number two, and bringing other Jews or other people who live here that are highly talented people. And we have to focus on that from an immigration or Aliyah perspective. The other part of this, there is no choice but for Israeli companies to do what companies like Monday and Wix have done, which is open offices in the Ukraine, Poland, and Argentina and wherever, and we have a couple of companies have done this too. We need to access bigger global talent pools to get after the market opportunities that are in front of our companies.
Michael, one last question. It's a bit of a selfish question. Your blog is called Six Kids in a Full-Time Job, but I know that's kind of false advertising because you're up to 8 kids already and you have not just a full-time job.
Wait. I call it false advertising. I prefer to call it, it wasn't saleable when I did it.
Okay.
I was before we brought out not scared. Well, it was true at the time.
I got it. Okay. But now you've been blessed with 8 children.
I have 2 more kids, okay?
You have 8 kids and a full-time job, and obviously your involvement in the public sphere here in Israel. I only have 4 kids, and, you know, I guess I'm more of the gig economy, so, you know.
So far.
But, no, I really... advice, thoughts on how you do it all, how you manage it all, being a father, being an investor, being a public figure.
Like I should mention also, not in any subway, but I is important. I share the Shomer HaDash, which is the Guardian, which is a large violence organization in Israel, and they're doing incredible work on protecting farmers from agricultural terrorism and protecting now the eastern border and the eastern border and another thing called Nevo, which helps immigrants to Israel in the high tech sector kind of get to their jobs. And the reason I mention these is not because I share them, but because like everything in life, how did I do this? I married extremely well. My wife's incredible. How do I do this? Because I partnered with Yoel Zilberman at the Shomer HaChadash, who's the CEO of the Shomer HaChadash, and I came after an incredible chairman before me, Ron Whaley and Yosef Zuckerman. How did I do this? Because my partner at Nevo is Abby Ohn, who's just done an incredible job with this Olim network of not just getting them integrated in high tech, but accelerated in high tech with a group of mentors there. And so I think the secret in life is kind of two things. Marry well. And I was very fortunate to meet my wife young, and we've had just an incredible relationship and partnership and raising a family together. And incredible partners business. At all, I've had incredible partners in the various nonprofit stuff that I've done, and you know that's the main thing. And we don't have a television,
And so I say that half in jest, but it's kind of true, which is I don't have that many hobbies in life.
How much time does Twitter take from your daily schedule?
Actually, very, very little. I do it in bursts. And by the way, even on the books that I've published, I have an incredible editor who is also a thought partner and challenges me really hard and fine tunes me quicker. So everything in life is who you partner with. And then my only two real hobbies that I have that I enjoy very much are skiing, which you can only do a small number of days a year, unfortunately, and drinking Israeli wine. I don't have many hobbies other than that. I just want to like write books and help Israel and the Jewish people. That's my life by now, and raise our family together. And so, that's it. I don't have any. The one thing I'll say, which I've said publicly in many places, I actually don't believe in work-life balance. I think this is a terrible promise that professors make to kids and psychologists make to kids. And it's just false. What is balanced about the last 2 years? And if I promise you that your life is going to be balanced and you encounter the last 2 years, you will have failed because there's no balance. You know, no one promised my daughter, who had three kids and now had her fourth in the middle of the war, and her husband was 300 plus days in reserve duty. Any balance this year? You know, my other
Love as well. Yeah. Love's husband has done hundreds of days as well.
Yeah, nobody promised balance. What we need to do is to people that there are trade-offs in life. There are just trade-offs because there's 24 hours a day and 7 days in a week, 30 minus days a month, and 365 days in a year and 254 days in the Jewish year. And there's just trade-offs. And we try to be as good as we can at everything, and we're going to fail. And that, I think, builds resilience. And what I think Israel has in spades is optimism and resilience. Optimism and resilience. And the reason I'm bullish on Israeli society, this generation, that's because they're battle-hardened. They have built resilience. You know, people like Lahav have built resilience. Lahav's husband has built resilience. My kids, daughters and sons-in-law and daughters-in-law have built resilience over the last 2 years. It hasn't been easy. Nothing is easy, okay? People promised easy. Sorry. But we have it. It's real. And that's real life. And will we pray it should be more peaceful? Yes. But if it's not going to be peaceful, let's at least the lessons out of it, which is resilience and optimism. If anyone told you we'd be where we are today, a weakened Iran, you know, Hezbollah on its back, Hamas on its back. After on October 8th, that they told you this, you would have said, you're smoking weed. But look what our kids have done. Look what Lav's husband's done. What incredible resilience. We got knocked on our butts and we got up and gave it back. And it's had a tremendous price. It still is a price. The hostages are still a price. And still people fighting in Gaza. And unfortunately, soldiers being killed. Okay. And a lot of broken hearts and a lot of widows and orphans. Are our responsibility collectively. They're our responsibility collectively. But we have, unfortunately, through trauma, built resilience, and now we need to get the post-traumatic growth phase. And I think that's what we need to go to right now. And that requires, again, urgent leadership to take us to the post-traumatic growth phase. And we can get there. We can get there and we can lead.
Michael Eisenberg, thank you so much for being here. For the inspiring closing message, we couldn't have asked for a better one.
Anytime. For the two of you, anything.
Thank you for listening to this week's Mideast Horizon. Be sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav. Go on www.misgavinst.org, and we're on all major social media. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com.